taking account of the turnover in our population, it might be fitting to look again at some of the literature that's available. I just took these off one of the shelves in the bookstore. Specifically looking at nonviolence as a way of working or as a lifestyle commitment, as that can be distinguished from anti-militarism, which is a closely related subject but not identified. First, two publications from the press of the University of Notre Dame, both of them published before I got there. Thomas Merton, a Trappist monk, became famous through his own spiritual autobiography, explaining how he himself had come to the monastic life, but in the last 10 or 15 years of his life, he became much more vocal. Trappists don't talk, but they may write, and he published a lot, beginning with the American Civil Rights struggle and then reaching beyond that. He became in his last years one of the spokesmen of a Christian nonviolent commitment. Faith and Violence is a collection of his own writings, some of them occasional, that is, book reviews, but going beyond just the book, meditating on something that a book raised, comments on current events of the time, which was late civil rights and early Vietnam. He also edited a thin collection of small quotes, Gandhi on nonviolence, which is one of the simplest ways to get acquainted in current available English publications with the thought of Gandhi, as seen already by someone appropriating that thought in a North American Catholic Christian perspective. On the same shelf, there is Ronald Sider, Christ and Violence. This is very different in its mood and orientation. Ronald Sider is from that part of the American Protestant movement that likes the word evangelical as a self-designation, with a pointed commitment to the dignity and lordship of Christ and to the authority of scriptures. He's also represented in the bookstore by even more widely selling things on the subject of world hunger. I think there are three of his writings on the hunger shelf. Christ and Violence is a lecture series which became a pamphlet and might be, of these books, the one most accessible to the ordinary reader of an ordinary church library that had never thought about these things before but would want them to be dealt with in biblical terms. The bookshelf does not have other writings of André Trukhme, who is one of the European thinkers from the time between the wars and until the 60s, who provided the most leadership, but there is a fragment of his biography, that is, the story of the village where during the Second World War, especially during the occupation of France by the Germans, he made of that village in the mountains of central France a center of the spiritual and actual resistance to the Nazi takeover of France, and especially saving the lives of Jews. Philip Holly is a North American historian or psychologist. I'm not even quite sure what his academic field is, but he became interested in the notion of reconciliation and sacrifice and defense, heard about Trukhme, studied this story, and has made it into a paperback that has been strikingly popular on the secular market. Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, the story of the village of Le Chambon and how goodness happened there. That's the part of the story of the ministry of André Trukhme, one of the three or four nonviolent leaders within French Protestantism, who has also written a book, Jesus Christ and the Nonviolent Revolution. One more figure from the Gandhian heritage, Lanza del Vasto, was an Italian Catholic philosopher, poet, who went to India, lived with and around Gandhi for some time, and came back to Europe, where he founded a nonviolent communal movement, which has survived him. He himself died just a few months ago, with its branches also in other parts of the world, including South America. Lanza del Vasto, or called by his disciples, Shantidas, he brought back Indian vocabulary. What is it? Peace leader, peace soldier, peace father. I forget what the exact meaning of the term is in Hindi. Return to the Source is his own pilgrimage story of his finding the Gandhian heritage and finding something Christian through Gandhi. The last... there are two more yet. Close to Merton, but beyond him in spelling things out as a Catholic nonviolent, and closer to you because he lives in Washington, is James Douglas. Douglas with two S's. The Nonviolent Cross, A Theology of Revolution and Peace. One of the incredible things about his ministry is that they still sell this book for $1.95. He's, as like Merton, a Catholic who has learned from Gandhi and King and put it together in a broader synthesis, which has contributed a lot to the activist wing of the nonviolent movement. That is, the people that actually make a point consistently of demonstrating actions of civil disobedience. And the last thing on the shelf that's worth looking at is from a non-pacifist. Well, this is the whole shelf. I don't mean the... There are other shelves worth looking at, too. The last thing I brought along to show you, Robert McAfee Brown, Religion and Violence. Brown is a mainstream middle Protestant theologian who had been at Stanford and at Union Seminary and back at Berkeley. He who interprets the issue of violence from a tolerant, open-minded, empathetic, but not nonviolent perspective, but still is therefore much more open than most mainstream Protestants to the nonviolent thesis. And it might also be, I think of these other books, if you want something introductory, this empathetic introduction to the theme by someone who doesn't come down on the nonviolent side completely would also be helpful. The others, all of them, are more personal. Now to come to our material for today, I propose for a change to read especially one prophetic word and connect it in our minds with some others. When Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount to his disciples that they were to be a city set on a hill, he wasn't being original. He was picking up an image of the prophetic heritage that occurs in numerous places in the Old Testament. It's in Ezekiel, and it's in some others of the minor prophets. But it's most dramatically stated in two passages, almost identical, which occur in both Isaiah and Micah. I'll read it in the version from Micah chapter 4. We all know it. But it's a good entry into the understanding of the Christian hope as the context for our theme today. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised up above the hills. Just stop to explain that image. Today, as was true then, the Temple Mountain at Jerusalem is not a high mountain. It is a hill, and the temple area is at the top of that hill, but it's a rather small hill in the middle of a basin surrounded by higher mountains. So that from the top of the temple hill, you look up all around to a horizon that's above you. Well, the prophetic vision imagines that as reversed, and that this is really the top of the chain of mountains of the highlands of Judea, so that when people come up, they really come up the whole way and a pilgrimage is a flow to a mountaintop. Many nations, people shall flow to it, many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples, shall decide for strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. That image, God restores the city, the people, and as God has restored the city, the world is to be healed by coming to that city to learn how to make peace. I think it's a significant omission. It doesn't say that the peoples will all go back to the rest of the world and stop eating pigs or start observing the rest of the ritual requirements of Jewish religion. It says they will make peace. They will make instruments of peace out of their instruments of war. Now, my question for today is how this kind of hope works. The hope that is expressed in the prophetic promises of peace through divine intervention to establish Jerusalem. In the book of Revelation, also the last chapter, we have the image of the new Jerusalem, which isn't something that is constructed by better and better masons and architects, but it comes down from heaven ready-made. So it is the action of God that restores the city and thereby brings salvation in a fulfilled stage. How does that hope work? This is a type of thought and of literature which the technicians call apocalyptic. That's from the Greek word, which means simply to uncover or to reveal. But this kind of literature, revelation literature, like our book of Revelation or like the book of Daniel, is interpreted by the people who are good at literature as dealing with reality in a distinctive way that doesn't mesh with our world and doesn't mean to, and is not meant just to be continuing the writing of our history. The book of Revelation, they talk about the heavens being rolled up like a scroll and the stars falling down. You can't explain that in terms of astronomy that anybody would see from Mount Palomar or give you a TV series on with the guidance of Carl Sagan. It doesn't connect with the real world as we know it, and doesn't intend to. That way of thinking is characterized by discontinuity. That is, what it means is not to be taken straight and literally. It's code language. Words are used that mean something else, maybe partly, some interpreters think, in order that if the Roman secret police had read this letter when it was being written, when it was being transported from Patmos to somebody else, they wouldn't have known enough to use it as evidence to convict anybody of treason. It's code language. It's image language. It's also discontinuous in the sense that the events being talked about come about for reasons that we don't produce. God intervenes. An angel blows a trumpet, and then something happens. Or the Lamb of God in the heavenly courtroom breaks a seal on the scroll of destiny, and then things happen. That is, causation, the way we think about it in our understanding of history, comes from outside rather than from the historical process. So it's an image of the work of God being discontinuous. God is going to intervene. The world in which he's going to intervene is our world. And it's talked about in terms of our world, but the way the intervention is described is not something that we can project or date or bring about or build up for, or even get ready for in any other sense than just waiting. That's the shape of this kind of literature in which the Christian hope is stated. God will save the world by intervening, not by something the Jews or the Christians will do to bring it about. Most Christian thought since then, and especially since a few centuries after that, has been unapocalyptic or anti-apocalyptic, that is, speaking in terms of historical continuity and looking at reality in terms that aren't so revelatory and prophetic and confusing. Now, one reason for that is that what that apocalyptic literature seemed to be promising doesn't seem to have happened. So it must have been wrong, or it must not have meant that, or it must not be the kind of literature you should take seriously. There are evidences in the minds of many readers that Jesus himself thought the world would end within a few weeks of the time he was speaking those words, or within a few months, or at the time of his death. There are evidences that some of the early disciples thought the world would only last a few more weeks or a few more years after that. We have one passage from the Apostle Paul writing to the Thessalonians in which he seems to expect to be there when the end happens. And then we have other passages from Paul seeming to indicate that he expects to die first, but still thinking of an end, that is, a divine intervention in the apocalyptic style in which God will guarantee that the world comes out all right, so we don't have to do that, and we can't. Well, that didn't happen, so it's wrong. That's the first reason that our culture since the Middle Ages has been anti-apocalyptic. The second reason is that we can make sense of the world as a unity. The scientific view of why things happen, the view of the universe that our studies have developed over the last 2,000 years makes it possible to understand why the stars go the way they do, why the floods come the way they do, how life goes on. All of the things that ancient man thought were the intervention of deity, whether capricious many gods or one sovereign god deciding how things should be. Now, we know why they really happen, because we know about genes and germs and syndromes and tectonic plates and everything else that makes things really happen. We can make sense of the world as a unity. So the idea of God's sovereignty consisting in the fact that when the time comes, he's going to stick his finger in and make it come out right, interfere with the ordinary working of history so that it will be saved, isn't congenial to our sense of knowing how things work. Not only can we understand history, we can take charge of it. There are more of us Christians around, at least that's what they thought in the Middle Ages when they had baptized everybody coercively. And the rulers are on our side, and the wise people are on our side, since they had forbidden the pagan philosophers to teach anymore. So we can run the place. And we can figure out what's the best way to make history won. We can calculate what way of putting pressure on future history is going to be effective, what you can do with wars and what you can do with legislation and what you can do with education, and we're controlling that all so that we can begin. Medieval man was beginning this, and modern man since the Enlightenment is very conscious of it. We can run the world. We are increasingly able to make things come out right. We know the laws. That's what a scientist does, finds out the laws, and then the engineer takes those known laws and implements them. So we have developed, in the modern Western world especially, an engineering approach to world history. And anything that really has to happen, we'll set about making it happen. So the idea that there are things we can't do, and we must wait or pray, and God will do them, that's more and more foreign to the sense of reality with which we are trained. There are still places in the world where people pray for rain, or dance for rain, but we know that the thing to do is to seed the clouds. Or people look to God at least to know when it would happen, and now we look to the local TV weather show to know whether it'll happen. That is, because we know that even the rains are not a gift of God in any intervening sense, but the outworking of the aerodynamics of jet streams and cloud patterns, which can be understood and can even begin to be manipulated. So the world is in our control. This modern sense of a non-apocalyptic world, we know how it works, and in fact we can help make it work, and we're getting better and better at knowing how to make it work, puts then a particular challenge to the gospel ethics that I've been talking about, which of course was developed in that other world. Since Kant as a philosopher, since Tolstoy as a popularizer, and those two people aren't saying the same thing, but they had similar adversaries, gospel ethics is seen as caught in the bind between two different ways of reasoning. One way of reasoning says that what is right is what works, and morality can be reduced now that we know so much about how things work and we know how causes have effects. Morality can ultimately be reduced to engineering, that is, to pragmatism, to the most useful outcome as the measure of what was the right thing to do. The right thing to do is the action which will produce the best outcome. Philosophers call that utilitarianism, or political philosophers call it realism, or logicians call it teleological, that is, something is right because of the goal toward which it works, and anything that aims toward the right goal is the right thing to do. You may differ on what most effectively points at the right goal, but working toward the right goal is what makes something right. An action is right because it is part of taking responsibility for engineering the course of history so that it comes out right. The other view says, and this is the old-fashioned one, so this is the one where the pigeonhole where they put the gospel ethic. Things are right because they're right. They're right because God said so. Not pragmatism, but principle. Not ends, but duty. So this pattern is called by the logician deontological, coming from the root de, which is in the Greek obligation, oughtness. But something is right because it's right, and if you do it for any other reason, if you do it because it's going to work, that's less honorable than if you do it just because it's right. The truly honorable person is the one who will never stoop to doing things for effectiveness or interest, but will only do them because they are right. On what grounds? Well, the philosopher will have other grounds. Immanuel Kant will state it in logical terms, but of course then the religious person would state it in terms of God told me so, or Jesus said so, or the Bible says so. So on the one hand, you have a genuinely modern utilitarian engineering approach to history and therefore to ethics. You ought to do what will make the course of history come out right. And on the other hand, you have the absolutist approach, which says you know what's right or wrong on other grounds than making the course of events come out right, and you just ought to do it because you just ought to do it. The realist or pragmatist case will in modern times be practically open to reasons for nonviolence, because there are fewer and fewer things that you can do with violence, because it's counterproductive in so many circumstances. As the weapons get bigger, it gets more and more counterproductive. So you can, as Robert McAfee Brown would do it, you can be pragmatically, practically nonviolent on utilitarian grounds. But that never excludes the possible cases, which you hope will be rare, but you should be ready for, where violence would, after all, be better than the other thing that you want to keep from happening. Only an absolutist, only a deontological ethic, this system would say, can be nonviolent theologically or consistently. But then it has to be apocalyptic, and that's where we get back to where we were before. Then it has to trust God to save the situation, because I won't. See, I'm so committed to doing what's right on other grounds than saving the situation that there'll be some situations I can't save. And that's only explainable if you believe that God's still going to stick his finger in sometime and interfere with the machine that he set going in order to save it. One of the technical terms they use for that in this kind of debate is Deus ex machina. Machina is spelled almost like our word machine, but in Latin it didn't mean machine. It meant the works behind the stage or above the stage in a theater. The Deus ex machina is God who comes down out of the sky on a cable in a 17th century play. Once the author of the play has got the plot in an impossible mess, a divine figure comes down and says, we change the rules now. That person isn't dead, that person isn't a criminal, this person isn't sick, and it all comes out right. So Deus ex machina doesn't mean God comes out of a machine, but it does mean he comes out of the works of the stage mechanism in order to make sure that the play has a happy ending. Well, that's the image that's used for this discontinuous understanding of history. In the face of that mindset, which says you must either reason pragmatically or from absolute principle, you must either be realistic or idealistic. Is it the case, this is the way the problem is set up, that the nonviolent position that claims to be rooted in the gospel is idealist and absolutist and wants to be called that and agrees that it can't take charge of history? That's the question to which we now have to move as the new puzzle. All this time I was just trying to set up the problem. Personally, as a part-time academic teacher of ethics as an academic discipline, I don't want to answer that question in those terms. I want to question the question. I want to doubt that that's the way to put the question. I want to challenge the self-evident feeling of most of my contemporaries in the field that you have to make that choice between those two and only those two ways of reasoning. And I could argue that more on an academic level. Nobody who claims to be only pragmatic is ultimately totally utilitarian and pragmatic, because they still have to explain sometime what they think is a good goal toward which to engineer the control they think they have of society. And no person called an absolutist, even Tolstoy, is consistently unconcerned for realism and effectiveness. So that's really a wrong way, descriptively, to set up the debates that we have. A deeper reason for not liking it is that there are other elements of the ethical reality that this way of putting the question doesn't deal with. Things that are just as important as the distinction between calculated effectiveness and trueness to principle, such as character. What kind of a person are you? What kind of a group of people do we claim to be? Vision, that is, the wider set of meanings besides just how you make a decision in a crunch. What kind of flow of history we're what we are in, narrative, what kind of community we're in. If all of those elements would be taken with adequate seriousness, we wouldn't be deciding, after all, between deontology, pure duty, and teleology, pure effectiveness. But that way of disagreeing with the question is academic and technical. So I won't expect that to be enough of an answer. Another part of the answer, and this couldn't have been said with the same clarity 20 years ago, is that some of the things I said about our culture's self-confidence and our trust that we know how to engineer the course of history are no longer being said with the same confidence by everybody. There is a beginning change of consciousness in the face of modernity, the ecological problematic, the difficulty of managing modern societies, the breakdown of the city. Our ability to see the universe whole, even though we have all of this enlightened scientific know-how, is broken, incomplete, demonic in a sense. It misleads us. It distorts as much as it clarifies our perception of what we can do. It leads us to think we can do things we can't do. It leads us to project futures which can never happen. Not only is that the case on the level of our understanding how things work, it's even more the case when we try to make them work. That is, we try to intervene historically and take charge, and then we use these mechanisms we think we understand, and they don't work the way they were supposed to because of our pride or because of the continuing limits of our knowledge. Our intervention to make things better doesn't always make it better, partly because we didn't know as much as we thought, and partly because we were abusing it for pride or for self-interest or trying to tilt the scales of world justice in our favor, so that just from the inside, this engineering approach to human control of the course of history is getting more modest and more aware of the broken and the demonic. From other perspectives, there is a renewed scholarly respect for this part of the biblical literature. The New Testament scholars in the past generation have started again trying to respect the apocalyptic literature instead of just seeing it as strange or kooky or otherworldly or bypassed by the course of historical progress. They're trying to ask, what did it mean when a writer would write that way to those people? And can we disengage that meaning without stumbling over the fact that it assumed a cosmology that doesn't fit with a Sputnik cosmology? Numerous German New Testament scholars and few Anglo-Saxons more recently have been rediscovering the possibility of thinking apocalyptically as not a bad way to think and not an outmoded way to think, because there are discontinuities in reality. It doesn't all hang together neatly. And then a number of people who are not themselves scripture scholars, but theologically insightful interpreters of our scene, have picked up even more the usefulness of this kind of approach and started seeing that it makes sense to see that our universe doesn't make sense. That is, that it is a responsible coming to grips with our reality to say that we can't dominate it. We can't see all of it whole. And it isn't whole. And it isn't all wholesome, but it is destructive and oppressive. So we have a book like William Stringfellow's Ethic for Christians and Other Aliens, and more recently a commentary on the Book of Revelation. We have from Jacques Ellul, the French Reformed sociologist and lay theologian, numerous books critiquing human self-confidence, partly as a very shrewd sociologist using the data of sociology, and partly as an insightful lay theologian reading the scriptures, and those things fitting together, in which the most clear things would we have to say about the world we're in is that it's messed up and can only be saved from outside, even though we can't explain anymore with our worldview what outside might be. One of the books that have been read around Holden Village for the last couple of years is by a Lutheran theologian named Hall, saying the same kind of thing about American culture and relating this to the message of the cross. There is a tape by John Schramm in the library on what it means for the church to be in the status confessionis. Now, whenever a Lutheran who has a seminary education uses Latin, you know it's important. Is the church in a position where some issue is of such importance that it's possible to deny the faith by taking the wrong position on that issue? And John doesn't come up saying yes to that, but on the way to not quite saying yes to that, he does say some of the things I've just been observing, that increasingly the Christians in America have to see themselves as in a strange land, as somehow in exile. And that fits with the question, how can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? It's with the awareness of being in a strange land, in a world we don't control, and it isn't going in the right direction, and it isn't sure to come out right, that we know what it means to be working at articulating the Christian faith. Now, what does that have to do with my subject? All of the major minds in the movement of nonviolence deny the split between the pragmatic and the principled. between an ethic which just does things because they're right and let the heavens fall, and an ethic which does the right thing because you can prove it's going to work well. That option, which ever since the Age of Enlightenment has seemed to us to be self-evidently a choice you have to make, in some crunches at least, is an option that Gandhi and King thoughtfully — they're not technical, philosophical or logical types, but they were both careful thinkers — thoughtfully looked at and said, we don't have to buy that. We don't have to agree that there's an ultimate choice between effectiveness and faithfulness. There may, in particular difficult situations, seem to need to be a choice between those two because of our short-sightedness or our not having all the facts, but fundamentally, we don't believe that you choose between effectiveness and faithfulness. So that if we regularly take the way of faithfulness, we can count on it to be effective. But the outsider says, aha, you're expecting God to intervene. You're counting on God to save the situation, because you won't intervene where it does seem that a violent action is needed in order to save the situation. Well, Tolstoy would have said yes to that. Tolstoy would have said, yes, I don't try to save the situation. I'll leave that to God. I don't know how it can work, but at least I know it can never be my calling to save the situation with violence. And I know that all the people that claim to be saving the situation with violence are really saving something else, their own pocketbook or their place as princes or as bishops or as generals. And I don't trust anybody that claims to be saving any situation with violence, but I never will. But as the Quakers and Gandhi and King moved beyond a simple negation to thought through social strategies, they all affirmed the unity of the hope that things will come out right, and their experience that when they loved their enemies, things did tend to come out at least better, and their commitment that they would never take shortcuts in order to save a situation through violence. So that they deny that in the long run, acting on principle and acting pragmatically are alternatives. And thereby they reject the grounds that are usually used, the pragmatic grounds for saying, sure, of course, generally violence is evil, but in this case, regretfully, we have to resort to it as the lesser evil. They set those grounds aside, not because they can prove every time that they can save every situation, but because they reject on fundamental grounds the idea that it's ever our business to assign ourselves the authority to make loopholes to the general wrongness of violence or the general rightness of respect for the dignity of the adversary. So they don't look at the question, absolute or pragmatic, and say, we choose absolute. No, they look at the question and say, that's not a question we need to answer. It's a wrong question. It's like, when have you stopped beating your wife? It's a question that doesn't permit the right answer. And one of the things you have to learn to think carefully is not to try to ask questions that don't permit a right answer. So the question itself is wrong. It isn't that they make a choice, the absolutist choice or the idealist choice. It's that they deny the appropriateness of that way of putting the question. Well, here I've been discussing hope as an idea. That it is the setting aside of the hope of God making it work in favor of trust in ourselves making it work, which then put to the last two centuries of Western thought this alternative between practical ethics and absolutist ethics. On the other hand, having the hope that the God we know in Jesus, even Gandhi knows in Jesus, is the one who we know in his way will bring peace to earth, that hope enables people to avoid having to decide between being absolutist and being effective. I've been saying that on the level of ideas, but it would be more fitting to remember that these ideas never just float around in the air or in libraries, but that they are the expression of the way people think in a given time and place. So it's worth asking when people tend to think of hope as God's intervention to save, in apocalyptic language, and when people tend to think of history as something that humans are to engineer because they can control it. What kind of society do we see in both cases? We've seen there's a linkage. If you hope in God to make things right, you will see love and justice in unity. And your ethic of love, you will count on to wind up in a world of justice. If, on the other hand, you have a closed worldview with no hope from outside or above, and an engineering view of what you do to make history come out right, then you will say you must sometimes abandon love for the sake of justice. That's the way the ideas connect. But now, who thinks that way? When did these thoughts arise? The utility model, the engineering model that says we must use violence once in a while to make the system come out right, fits a church in control of the world. It becomes a pattern of Christian thought after the 4th century, when Christians took over Europe and fused the value structures of the church with those of the Roman Empire. And then it was thinkable that we can control the world. They didn't yet know about mechanical causation the way we do, but they knew a lot about political causation. And they knew that if a preacher can get the ear of the emperor, a lot of things can happen. So that's the beginning of the vision of a world in which we make the decisions about how to make it come out right instead of acting out of pure love and letting God make the decisions. On the other hand, the hope model fits a church under the cross, a church which has no control. And that's where we actually find it, in the New Testament or in the late Old Testament, in which the Jewish people also were living in that situation. The view that doesn't take responsibility for running the world is the view that we find on the part of churches not in power. Beginning with Jeremiah, Jesus, the book of Revelation, and Christians today in the Soviet Union. In all such places where the God people have no access to the powers that are visibly effective in managing the world, it continues to be meaningful to talk about a hope from above. In a culture where you assume that you can take responsibility if you want to, because there are enough of you, and you have the insight, and you have the connections, or you have the weapons, you will be optimistic about your chance of making the world come out better. And then you'll be disappointed, as especially America is right now, about not winning, about not gaining ground, and about the progress image not continuing to get better and better and better, but finding that at some places it seems to be rotten at the core. If you make power assumptions, you will trust your goodness, you will trust your own righteousness more than that of your adversaries, you will trust your tools, your control of things, your estimates of what the chances are that it'll work the way you're doing it, and you will justify moral shortcuts and loopholes on the grounds that you have to be responsible to make things come out as well as they can. Now, if it were really true that the good guys were in control, if the power situation which this way of thinking assumes really did obtain, then sometimes the case for necessary violence and benevolent lordship would have a logical coherence. But it gets all the funnier when, in our society, the good guys don't have control. However you define it. And yet we keep on using the responsibility language that comes from a situation of control. And then there's not only that this control language doesn't fit the gospel, but it doesn't fit historical realities either. And people keep themselves from perceiving that we're in an apocalyptic world that's really out of control by the persistence of their inherited optimistic Western view of the human capacity to make things come out right. Well, I could talk more about that notion of social responsibility and control independently of this, but I think I better stop pretty soon and open this for a different kind of discussion, because it's a different kind of material from the other times. Now, when the Christian in general, speaking on the broadest sense of Soviet Baptists and anybody in a situation under the cross, denies the case for an engineering approach to ethics, denies that we ought to make our moral decisions on the grounds of how it'll make the world come out, this does not mean, it doesn't even mean in Tolstoy, being in principle against effectiveness, where you can calculate really elements of the effects of your action. It doesn't mean blind obedience. Gandhi and King were enormously shrewd and rational within their ethic of commitment to total nonviolence. They were careful about timing, about when to march and when to sit in and when to call an action off. They were creative, one could even almost call them artistic, in knowing what gesture is the right gesture to make a point, choosing the symbols that would have leverage. They just did not assign to themselves the authority to use that sense of causation and effectiveness to authorize exceptions to their nonviolence for some good cause. So that to argue against what I've been calling by shorthand the engineering approach to social process doesn't mean I'll just do what's always right and trust God for the consequences. No, we'll think, we'll test, we'll debate strategy, we'll argue about short-range goals. We just won't let those commitments to strategy and goals lead us into taking into our hands the authority to violate the dignity of our adversaries, or to claim to take over with any kind of pride the historical process. Paradoxically, servanthood is powerful. Renouncing lordship, renouncing control, is in some ways, in some places, the strongest thing you can do. There are many more ways that this could be talked about if we were to try to itemize it, but just on the simplest level, those particular skills that it takes to run a culture, to be in control, the skills that it takes to run the courts, for instance, of a nation, or to run the established church, or the established university, or just to be king and queen, those skills are not socially creative. They are maintenance functions. The people that invest in having those skills will find work and will find work for their children, but they won't contribute much to social change. Those institutions are not meant to contribute to social change. Whereas the people that get pushed out of those maintenance functions in society find themselves doing the exploratory things in society, or finding alternatives which will contribute to change in the long run. I'd like to illustrate this by an understated parable, a true one, but it's kind of smaller than the point it's trying to prove. Do any of you have enough experience living in England that you know what the best kind of chocolate in England is? And second best? Roundtree. Those are both Quaker families. Were any of you in the Netherlands to know what kind of chocolate is best? It's Van Houten, the Mennonite family. In the 1700s, the established church dominated the court and the courts and the university and the church, that is, the legal profession. A bright young boy had to go into commerce. The real cultural frontier of the 17th and 18th centuries was shipping, from which you bring back chocolate, and merchandising, so you process your chocolate and sell it. So in the age when the cultural frontier was one world commerce,
The Peace Church people got into that because they couldn't get into the maintenance functions of their society, and turned out to contribute more to the social progress of that particular generation of social change than the people who theologically ran the country, the Anglicans in England and the Reformed in the Netherlands. Well, that's just a tiny parable for the way in which the servanthood stance in society turns out to be powerful for change. Whereas the lordship stance that says we are morally responsible to run this world because if we don't run it, there'll be no hope, turns out not to fulfill even its own hopes. So the question about the apocalyptic view of the world is not so much whether it really makes sense to us as it does to Hal Lindsey to think that the cosmology of the first century is still credible, but it's whether the morality of the first century is still credible, whether we can still trust God to make our obedience line up with the fulfillment of history. Because you can't sight down the line of the cross and make sure you'll hit a resurrection at the other end. You can aim in a carnival stand. You can aim your rifle and hit the duck at the other side. Some people can even do it in real life and hunting for birds. But you can't sight down the line of the servant stance and see how it will work, that will produce justice. But it does. It has in history, and it will in the long run, according to the witness of the prophets. So that those who trust nonviolence, trust the renunciation of violence, are not saying they don't care about effectiveness. They're saying they won't take over effectiveness because they don't trust themselves to be the arbiters of effectiveness. They trust God for that, and they'll do what they're called to do in servanthood and loving their enemies instead of lordship, and leave it to God when that will turn out to work.
I'm not sure I understood everything you said to this question. I kind of have a feeling that we're to live with tenaciousness about things, but on the other hand, great nonchalance. But from what I know about Mennonite tradition, for instance, where can you be a servant in the world? Like, evidently, I don't think you feel that you can be in Congress. But can't you be in Congress and not be working? Well, yes, you would be working to change structures. Where do you work with the tenaciousness, or where can you work as a Christian, not feeling that you're going to be changing things? Oh, that's a terrible question.
Well, I'll start by arguing only against the question of whether it has anything to do with Mennonite history, which is a peculiar cultural enclave, which doesn't necessarily serve as an explication of much of what I'm talking about. Because I don't mean to be understood as a confessional interpreter in an ecumenical scene, so much as trying to use later debates to illustrate our common effort to get the New Testament straight again, or even Jeremiah. So I somehow don't find it the most interesting question to know how many of us ought to be running for public office, and how many of us ought to be teaching school, and how many of us ought to be going off to the woods and finding alternate energy sources. All of those things make some sense. I'm asking with what rationale somebody would do something. And it would be
the question, and it's not the position that they have or what they're
doing. No, it's how they think about power. And if it be the case that Mark Hatfield is willing to vote his conscience instead of his constituency and vote against the Pentagon budget, then I could be that kind of a senator. I wouldn't get elected. But neither would he if he weren't the incumbent. So it isn't a question of where you are in society, but whether in that place you reason, you make your moral decisions on the ground of engineering and control, or on the grounds of faithfulness and truthfulness and trust. And so you're willing to lose the ones you lose. If I ran for Congress, it would be in Congress that I should do so. But if I were elected, I would expect to lose most battles. But maybe some of us ought to do that. I would also lose most battles if I were elected president of a church or a bishop. It isn't the question of the place, at least not in a pluralistic society, not in an open society. I couldn't be a part of the Hitler regime if I got elected there. I couldn't get, because there the whole system is so defined that the only honest thing to say is no to the whole system. But I wouldn't say that of any Western democratic state where there's room for dissent. And I'd have less problem being a legislator who can always vote no than being a middle-level bureaucrat who sometimes is less free to act according to conscience. Or a middle-level administrator in a multinational corporation or a bank who has sometimes less freedom than a legislator has. So I'm not talking about positions, I'm talking about stances. And whether we really believe that we must take it in our hand to control history, and that that's the excuse or the need, mandate, for resort to violence in extreme cases.
But don't all of us, wherever we are, act because we think that we're going to make a difference? Now, for me, it's very hard to draw the line between acting out of conscience and what I feel is faithful, and not hoping that it's also going to be effective. I just think that's tough. I hear what you're saying.
Is it the difference of whether you expect it to work or whether you're called to be faithful and do the faithful act? You're not you don't have such a great concern about whether it's going to work out, that you're going to that things are going to work out the way you want it. That you do the faithful act and not have your eye on the goal, but just see that it's the faithful thing to do. And if you can get beyond that need for effectiveness. And that's, I think that's the difference. I think it's the difference between just thinking about everything in terms of whether it's going to be effective and then thinking about whether it's going to be faithful, and just knowing that it's faithful, knowing that in the long run it will be effective in God's plan.
Yeah. Well, if I'm to interpret the way Gandhi and King talked about the ends means things, it was usually in terms of ends and means that they stated this, I shouldn't have, and you shouldn't have ever to make a choice between doing the thing that's right and trusting that it will be effective. It's the other side that says, this time I have to do something wrong because I have to be effective. It's at that point that it makes a fundamental structural difference to our thought. That's what we were talking about with Bonhoeffer yesterday. In an extreme case, he said it's schuld, it's guilty, it's even sin, but it must be done because of some other dimension of not being irresponsible in a crucial situation. And at that kind of decision, then the separation between hope and effectiveness, or between faithfulness and effectiveness, is brought in, where Gandhi and King and I say, we shouldn't bring that in. So we shouldn't have to choose between the two. It's the other school of thought that chooses between the two. And it's the dominant school of thought in Western culture.
In back to Mary's question about, are there positions that we cannot hold if we're to be faithful to a gospel of non-control? I almost joined the army when I was 18. Now, that's the last thing I would do on God's earth. I see that as an unfaithful position, to be linked to military control of human beings. I see the stance issue as being true in many, many professions. But the pre-Constantine church fathers said, you can't be a Roman soldier and be a Christian, or some of them, many of them said that. Isn't that now part of reclaiming the truth of the gospel?
No, I think there will always be some evident cases. But I'm not interested in being utterly clear about the borderlines of that as a way to test my ethics. And in different times and places, I wouldn't mind if that's different. There's a Swiss citizen never joins the army. There is no induction. You're just born a soldier. You have citizen-soldier status by birth. Well, then it means something different than in another country where there are only volunteer soldiers, or in another country where there is an act of accepting recruitment and swearing the oath. Each of those cases, what it means to be a soldier is different. The early Christians at least until the middle and latter part of the second century, were firm that soldiering was not compatible with being a member of the church. But they seem to have let the converts who were soldiers finish out their term rather than become deserters right away. So even there, there was a strong position, but there was flexibility at the fringes in its implementation and as a matter of church discipline. In that sense, I would feel it a misinterpretation of what I'm talking about for me to be pushing for firm, specific lines that apply everywhere. But sure, there will be some lines. I don't think even Lutheran churches would think that it can be a Christian calling to manage a house of prostitution. That's a function that our society needs. It keeps the syphilis off the streets. But it isn't a Christian calling. So the Lutheran doctrine of vocation doesn't apply to all vocations, only to some vocations. Although when Lutherans talk to Mennonites, they make the point that you ought to take them all in, but they don't really take them all in. And there aren't many Lutheran mafiosi, or at least I don't think so. So the doctrine of vocation can never be used, not even by the other views, to say all positions are all right. So I don't want to get into a debate about where the lines run between the positions that are all right and those that aren't and those that are sometimes questionable. But I've sometimes argued that people from our Peace Studies program in Peace Church seminaries should apply for chaplaincy positions in the Army, because that'd be a very good place to preach that war is wrong. And then when the Army or the Navy says, we won't hire you as a chaplain, then you go to court, because that constitutes the establishment of religion, that an organ of the United States government decides who counts as a preacher and who doesn't. So I have been advocating that some Mennonites ought to join the Army. I haven't found anybody that wanted to do it. So let's be flexible about where the line runs if we know that there is a line, but that the fundamental spiritual and ethical question is, how do we think about these matters? And that's the point at which somebody, if somebody says, I have to make this exception to my loyalty to Jesus in order to make the world come out right, that's the crunch decision that I have to say I can't make. But after I got clear on that, then I want to be more flexible than many people in standing with people as they pilgrimage along from where they start.
Now, how about the question of civil disobedience? In the light of the call that's especially in Romans to obey the Roman government, and then the dilemma that you face, that you choose willingly to disobey. Doesn't that fall under the area of making things come out right and choosing the lesser of evils? Because you disobeyed the government, you can't.
Well, there are people for whom civil disobedience or nonviolent tactics of obstruction may be unloving and may be brutal and may be intended to be coercive. That is, really to leave no dignity to the people on the other side at all, really twist their arms so that they have to do what we want. I don't think normally or ideally or properly that's the case. There's a chapter in my Jesus book that explains that Romans 13 doesn't say we should obey the government. It says we should be subject to it, which is something quite different. Namely, a civil disobedient person, a person who does an act of civil disobedience, but accepts the price of it. That is, if it is punishable by law, they accept the punishment. Is doing what Romans 13 called for. They're accepting that it is the government that is there that governs them and has the right to make them pay for their nonconformity. So civil disobedience, I don't think, is against Romans 13. The New Testament also talks about disobeying man when obedience to God is at stake. But what we need is more of what I called an art or a charisma rather than an ethical decision about the places where that act is fitting. I think it would have been fitting that many more German Christians, most of them Lutheran, would have disobeyed Hitler for very obvious reasons in the 1930s and early 40s, and that wouldn't have been at all a conscience problem in the face of their obedience to God, because it was clear that Hitler was asking them to do things that they shouldn't have let him ask them to do. So disobedience, when called for, is not counter to Christian respect for government in its proper functions, or even Christian submission to improper government, which is also called for. by Romans 13. But when and how to disobey, there are two different ways to go, and that's a real problem that we just have to itemize here, that is, put it on the list and maybe think about it some other time. Some acts of civil disobedience are because you tell me to do something I cannot possibly do conscientiously. There have been Soviet soldiers who refused to shoot people in Afghanistan because they thought it was wrong, and they gave their life for that. Martin Luther says a soldier should do that if he knows he's being asked to fight in an unjust war. And then there are situationally chosen times to disobey, climbing over a fence or sending in your draft card. And those aren't because it would be wrong to do the opposite. Those are because this has been chosen as a symbol. And that's a much more complicated thing to talk about. It would demand a different discipline. And it isn't necessarily always right. Because it isn't, I have to disobey you because to obey you would be a sin. But I have chosen to disobey you because I'm trying to make a point. And that has to be talked about in terms of homiletics. How do you make a good point? How do you communicate something by this exceptional action? I'm sorry for going long. I keep kind of instinctively thinking that the hour ends at the hour.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you.